Accession number 28879, Reel 11.
Or just a cent.
Yeah.
And in this particular time there, he'd been out with the Rajputs. When he came back there, we were quite tired, you know, coming back. And I was just going to go up one way. And one of the fellows said, "Hey, no, that's not the way." And I was a bit doubtful, you know. I thought, I'm pretty certain. And nobody else knew the way, because I've been leading all the time. Most of the time,
right.
Not in this particular group. So I thought for a minute, no, it's a bit dodgy. And just a quick pace further down, I thought, no, it's no other way, no, I thought, this is the way. So I said, I'm pretty certain it's the way, I'm off. So I went off to carry on up, got so far, and it was all right. I found the track, said all right.
Yeah.
But it was a case of using common sense as well, you know, with the track as well. But in the dark, of course, but then I've done it so many times, it was all right. But there again, they all follow with a sigh of relief, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they're expecting to see me go up. But then, you can understand it, because some of them were injured themselves up on the Italian wire, because on the way there, in different places, the Italians have put anti-personnel bullets in.
Yeah.
Like a tube sunk in the ground, with a flat top, flat ridge, sunk into the ground there, and then a bullet put in. And the bullet just protruded above. So if you put your foot on it, you pressed it down against the striker, and the bullet came up through your foot.
Right.
It was nasty, so.
Right.
But they were just petty tricks, you know.
Wow.
The book was full of incidents, in lots of ways. There's one, we went out to catch prisoners one time. And we went through the Italian wire and up around a couple of the the big Sangers they had there,
mm-hmm.
in the hope of trying to catch one going back, you know. But then we suddenly come across this Italian crouch down there. So I just tapped him on the shoulder and I said, "Stand up, money and alto," you know. And he would grunt. And he started to stand up, and I thought he was never going to stop standing up. He was a huge chap. And when he was stood up, he must have been about 6'5" or so. He reminded me exactly of Primo Carnero. You remember him at all?
No, I don't.
The Italian world champion just before the war, boxer.
Right.
But he didn't last long, you know, but he's a lumbering big chap. We bundled him off, struggling along with trying to get his trousers up. We managed all right. But, he was terrific size. And the Rajput... When we got back to the cheetah listening post, which we manned now and again, they were manning it, mm. As we got back towards it, they saw this, they said all they could see of everything was this huge Italian flying up. And they never knew his name afterwards. We just handed him over, you know, and that was it. As I say, it was much more fun at times than anything, you know, apart from the occasional odd chance, but... But then the point is we enjoyed it, you know, at least I did, and most of them did as well, you know.
Yeah. Did anyone ever request to go back to their unit? Did anyone ever request to leave special
forces? One was sent back at one time. There was a sergeant, and in training he was dashing all over the place with his bayonet and everything else, you know, playing the big soldier. That was all right when we were in training. But we got there, not long after we got to Dobruk, we got behind the ridge there at one time for ablutions and sanitary arrangements and everything else, you know, in a little area behind the wadi. And the plane came over, straight over the top of the hill, and came straight down the field at one, open fire. We all managed to take shelter, but one of the sergeants there, he's absolutely prostrate afterwards.
Right.
Scared stiff, yeah.
What did it?
He dirtied his trousers and everything else, you know.
Yeah.
But, he was so shaken up, he was sent back to Alexandria. He became the post corporal afterwards.
Right.
And as I say, he was chasing around there on training, full of it. But that's how it happened to some of them.
But there's no progression,
the is there? They all took to it. There were two...
Was that the only case you knew of someone whose nerves didn't take it?
Not there, no, I don't think so, no. Not in my area, anyway.
Right.
They all took it, even on the submarines and everything else. We talked about it afterwards, you know, talking about the scares we had on the submarine and different noises and the ships when we were being hunted as well, you know.
That
was the worst thing, it's hearing ships come near you, come by.
You hear the propellers.
But as far as I know, none of them ever suffered any nerves or anything.
Right. Quite surprising, really.
No, but I think we just took to it. No, it's typical British, I suppose, in one sense.
Yeah.
But then we were all volunteers, you see, in that sense.
And you're well trained and experienced. Yeah,
well, not only that, but whenever we got into a state or into a mess, we used to say to ourselves, well, what the hell are we doing in this place? Like, how did we get here?
Yeah.
And then we just say to ourselves, well, we volunteered, and that explains it all. We know there's no further bother, we just start doing something about it.
Right. Right. So, where were we? Cambridge. Major Sutherland says to you...
Sutherland, yeah.
He says, right, Bill, you're in the SAS now, then what happened?
Well, I got out... I told you I was in the hospital, wasn't I? Nearly better. And the officer came up to pay me from the Brit.
Mm.
And he said that Major, I think it was, whether he was Major, no, Captain, he's still Captain Sutherland, didn't he? And he said, Captain Sutherland says that we've got something on sometime. He said, how soon before you get out? He said, it'll be within a few weeks, you know.
Well,
so I said, well, I think I'm all right now, but I went to see the therapist, and he said, no, he said, it'll be a while yet, you know. We started talking it over. I didn't want to, because what would have happened? They would have gone back through the usual channels, and it would have taken weeks to get through. You know?
Right.
So the officer said, "Well," he said, unofficially, he said, "You could just get in the jeep with me now." He said, "And go straight back down to Cabrit, and let them sort things out afterwards. As long as you certain yourself, you know." Well, I was pretty certain.
Mm.
The arm was still bandaged, but it was like I still used it and everything. So we did that. I just went back to the bunk and the bed. Got the packed up my kit. I gave a pair of boots to one of the young nurses there as a parting present, you know.
Yeah.
And because she thought I was off officially anyway, but that was all right.
Right.
We had rubber sole boots in those days with suede tops, mm-hmm. and they were very much prized everywhere. And I was a size 6, right. I was fitted for anyways. She was marvellous during the air raids on the hospital, you know. She'd be walking down the ward, calming everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Very good.
Mm.
Anyway, got in the jeep and went to Cabrit, and Sutherland met me, and he said, we're going out to Beirut now, he said, up to the submarine depot, because it had moved up to there from Medway, from the Alexander, but the Medway had been sunk in the meantime, isn't it?
Yeah.
So we went to Beirut and reported to the submarine commander there, Papa Nicholas. I forget his name now, though. It's typical Greek type, you know. Boisterous type, reported there, and got to know the ropes and everything. And before long, we met the Greek guides and the Greek officers, and then we were off. And it was only when we got to somewhere past Cyprus that they told us where we were going then, you know, to Rhodes.
Mm-hmm.
But then we knew more or less. I kept asking the Greek guy, they only knew Italian, they didn't know, they could speak Greek but not know English.
Right.
And we kept trying to wheedle it out of him, you know, where we were going, where he came from, but he wouldn't say. Not Daniel, that is. Hello? Yes? No, I'm sorry, I don't know anything about that. We're both in our mid-80s, and we live in a council house, so there'll be no use. God, I'm in advertising again.
This time
of night. God, so.
Right, Bill. Towards, say, Arabs or...
taking us up to Alexandria in a lorry, and they hit a fellow. They hit a, a, an Arab.
Ran him over?
On the road, yes. Oh. The lorry did. And the driver got out, and there was a crowd around there, squabbling around there, shouting and bawling, and a red cap came up, and he said, he's still alive. He said, the best thing you can do, he said, is to get back in the lorry and pick up and back over him and run him over again. I was on the lorry at the time when they said that.
Right.
And it turned out afterwards that there was far less fuss if you killed an Arab than if you'd injured him.
Right.
There was sort of riotous if you injured him. They were all clamouring around, but if you killed them, they more or less took it for granted, so to speak. And
yeah.
If it was an accident, mind you. Know,
yeah.
But this business of putting him up, putting him back behind and running him over again.
So what did you do? What happened in the end?
Well, he didn't. This was just a suggestion he made at the time.
Yeah.
But he said it from experience, you know. He said that if you kill them, it's much less fuss.
Right.
So that's probably why he said it, you know. Not that they would ever deliberately do that, but the fact remains that if you killed an Arab in an accident, it's far less fuss than what did if you injured one, you know. So.
And what were relations like with the Indian, you know, the colonial regiments?
Well, the Indian troops were getting... There's nothing wrong with it at all. We treated them, well, they were equals, didn't they? They're better than we were.
Yeah.
Various.
Was that a widely held view that they were?
Especially the Gurkhas. The Gurkhas were into brooks in some places, though, you know. And they were also off in the desert, too.
Yeah. Because he must have had battalions, white English battalions, and colonial battalions next door to each other, mustn't he?
Well, the point is, what we did, I didn't have a lot to do with them up there, too, because. Well, it was more or less all my operations were pinpoints and things like that, you see, so I wasn't with them all the time, but I did come up against a mass of infantry troops over in the desert as well, you know, we came across them now and again, and met them back in Alexandria too, and there was all sorts of stories there, you know, we met them in the canteens and places like that.
I mean, of course, you'd grown up in India, but it had a lot of, for a lot of troops, was that the first time they'd seen
an
Indian or a black or whatever?
The majority of them admired the Indian troops. Well, they always stood their ground, the Indian troops did, or mostly Rajputs. That's all I can remember of in the desert. They were Rajputs from Pakistan.
Yeah.
And that's where Britain was held sway most of the time, didn't they? In the Sindh Desert, in the Punjab, as they called it then, you know.
Yeah.
They always constantly travelling up through there to the northwest frontier against the Afghans. You know.
So but they had white officers, did they, the Indian battalions?
Not all of them, no. They had Indian officers.
They had Indian officers as well.
In Tobruk, they had Indian officers. You know.
Right.
But some of the battalions had Indian, English officers.
Were there any in the SBS, SAS? Or was that all white?
No, but there was one Indian in the SBS on the... administrative side.
Right.
Because I used to speak to him now and again, you know. And because I wasn't all that well educated myself, you know, I wasn't all that well up even at that time.
Right.
In worldly experience, you know. But he was teaching me various points about the Urdu language.
Uh-huh.
And he suddenly he knew I spoke a bit of Italian, and he suddenly broke into Italian as well, you see, just to explain the Urdu. And just quite admiring. Well, I just said, "Oh, you speak Italian as well." I said, "You understand all that?" He said, "Of course I do." He said, "You think I'm stupid?" And that was a reaction from the general attitude that they had about the Indians. You know that they had no intelligence, but they were damn sight more intelligent than we were, and better educated than some of them. You know,
so
we met a lot of those and that types. But
so, do you think that did those attitudes change? Do you think the war changed those attitudes?
The war certainly changed it. I think myself here. Yeah, as regards the Egyptians, which is the only ones I had most experience of, and the Palestinian Arabs as well, but we began to admire them a lot more afterwards, you know.
Yeah.
After later on, towards the end in 1942.
It mixed everyone up a little bit more.
In fact, when I went back to Palestine, we used to go across from Port Said in a ferry, across to the other side, to Abu Qir.
Yeah.
On the Sinai side, you know,
mm-hmm.
back on after being spending a night in Port Said, and of course the Arabs travelled, the Egyptians travelled as well. And at one point, there were a couple of young thug English soldiers. They were bullying and knocking an Egyptian about.
Right.
And this, they had a terrific outcry from Medek and the others once, and an officer went down, and he grabbed both of them, he called two NCOs over from somewhere, or two or three NCOs, he said, take these men under arrest, he said, I'm charging them when we get to the other side, when he got to the transit camp, you know.
Yeah.
And as I say, there's no bother at all there. But normally before, you'd see Egyptian being bull-ragged and bullied and things, and no one did anything about it, you know.
Mm. Mm.
And the Egyptian would just sort of mutter a few words and off he'd go. But they certainly were treated with respect afterwards, I know.
Right, as it went on, yeah. Did you notice a big change when you came across the American army with black troops?
What's it? In Egypt, in Africa?
Well, as you went up Italy, you must have come across the American army.
Well, we met the American army, just as I said, when we were on our way back as ex-prisoners.
Right,
and they were complete help there, everywhere, no bother, you know. And anything you wanted, they would help. They transported us at one place all the way across southern Italy to Naples,
right,
where the English we supposed to have had a return prisoners organisation. They let us down,
right,
and the Americans took over and brought us over, hundreds of us.
Yeah,
of course, they came from all over the place.
Did they have a similar? Did they think of native people in a different way? I mean, do you remember how their black troops were treated? How their lot of blacks?
Well, there was definitely. I saw a certain coldness with them, with the black, because most of the lorry drivers were black anyway.
So, right.
So I did notice that the American troops weren't so friendly, went like that, with the black troops and the black drivers.
It was noticeable, was it?
Yes, it was, yeah.
What did you think of that?
Well, I didn't think much of it, because we heard all about the Negroes, the way they were treated, and the blacks in America.
Did the army talk to you about that at all? Do you remember? I know some people, when the Americans came over to England, the Black Army, you know, and the Air Force and that came to England, there were sort of propaganda films went around saying, you know, the Americans are coming and you're going to see some things that are a bit shocking.
I remember radio, quite frankly, but,
right.
But I remember that, can you remember that song about the chocolate soldier from the USA?
No.
The song out at the time, called... I forget how it went, exactly when, but it ended up each verse with "Chocolate Soldier from the USA,"
right.
And the Americans took a great exception to it at the time.
Right.
And at one time, I think in places it was banned.
Yeah.
And then it was banned. The other reason why it was banned is because they thought that the black soldiers themselves resented it, but they didn't at all.
Right.
You have them whistling it and singing it as well. You know, they're quite proud of it. You know? It's definitely a song of admiration more than anything, you know.
Right, right.
But there was a couple of lines in it about the Yankees, you know.
Mm.
But anyway, I can't remember.
What did you think of the American Army? What did it seem like?
The American Army in general, not too good, but as I said before, that individually, they had their... They were good soldiers, not the ways, you know. They were patriotic to start with. They were brave. They weren't too boastful or anything like that.
Oh.
And those that I met in Italy on the way back, as we were going down through, when we were coming back as prisoners, they were quite good, you know. They were very good soldiers.
Oh.
But what they lacked, as I said before, was... lack of confidence in their organisation.
Yeah.
As I said before, the British Army had more or less 1,000 years of the rule of law, you know, and that we've learned to respect them.
We've done a bit of practice, haven't we?
Our own, yeah, that's true. And fighting everywhere, too.
Yeah.
But they had a great deal of confidence in the British the Army's organisation, you know.
Right.
There was no discipline was very good in British, and it was just not quite the same in the with the Americans, you know.
Mm.
Although they were harsher on them, if they're going AWL, they were much more severely punished than we were, than our own troops were. You know, so they were really, really harsh on them. There's a great deal of shouting and that sort of thing, but we went out with the British Army towards the end of the war, and there wasn't much of it at all.
What was discipline like in the SBS and the SAS? Was there a need for it?
Well, it was a cooperative discipline. Nobody questioned anything at all. You couldn't argue at all. We didn't grumble because we had the opportunity of arguing and about the plans and whatever was to take place, you know. Like on on the roads one, the last meeting we had was the final checkup of the gear we would need, you know, and they left out blankets. And I thought to myself, well, I've been up in the hills, you know, in the summer and or in the winter as well, and knew what it was like high up. It got quite cold.
Right.
And they left out blankets because of the weight problem and everything else. Uh-huh. They left out that. Well, we didn't argue about it at the time. Though I did bring it up. I said, you probably need blankets, you know. But it wasn't a question of arguing. But we eventually did.
Right.
We had to make do with the sacking we had to wrap up the bombs under, wrap around our legs to keep warm.
Where was this meeting?
This was at Beirut.
And who gave the talk?
At the Basse Navarre. We always used to call it the Basse Navarre. It was all French names there, you know. Right. The French had been there for years, hadn't they?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it was about the naval base, we called it. That's where the meeting, the last meeting.
Was Sutherland sort of in command of that?
Pardon?
Did Sutherland give that talk and that meeting?
Yes, we were all there. The three, the Greek officers, the two guys weren't there. The two Greek officers were there. And they all contributed, you know, to
was there someone in overall command?
Sutherland was in charge. He was the senior captain there.
So how many of you were at that meeting?
There was four, five, six, two Marines, three Marines, myself, a corporal, and a private Blake,
uh-huh.
Two officers, and
the two Greek officers and Alec.
Of course, they were all experienced in that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But this was a special raid, because it was the longest. It was going to be the longest raid ever. They were going to take over about 10 days or more, you know.
Yeah.
The raid itself, but the travelling. We landed in the most remote area, and then we had to travel across the island and everywhere. And that's probably why. But there was nothing else that we missed. Missed out. Everything else worked out all right.
Mm-hmm.
But in any case, most of the time that we were talking about plans, what we were going to do, and who was going to do what, and that.
Would Sutherland lay the plan out? Would he? Sutherland would say, right, this is what the idea.
He'd say this will be done or anything like that, and he'd be rather like. If I remember rightly, he'd be rather like Sterling himself. He said, I rather thought this might be a good idea, and that sort of thing.
Yeah, you know, so he'd be suggesting things rather than giving orders.
He always back it up with what another knowledge and conviction as well, so
yeah.
He never really argued, but he'd say, I rather thought you would do this and so-and-so, and Sergeant so-and-so would do that. But most of the time, according to the army pamphlet, The orders are, you will do this and you will do that.
They
will
yeah.
And that no happy, you know. But yeah, you could. We used to discuss it ourselves afterwards among the NCOs and the men.
Mm-hmm.
And
if anyone had a suggestion, they could put it forward.
It's pretty thorough.
Right.
Nothing ever went wrong in that sense. So.
Did you know the Marines? I mean, you kind of known the rest of
two Marines. I didn't know because they. They were volunteered early on in the commandos, you know. They were in the main commando. As I said before, the main Marines, the brigades of Marines, weren't commandos until 1942, and they were suddenly made into commandos.
Yeah.
And then given the training afterwards. But,
but
these are volunteers.
Right.
And there are quite a few Marine volunteers. Marine Hughes, for example, he stood out amongst them quite a lot. He was a bit like myself in one way. He didn't give a damn what he did. He'd go anywhere, you know, go anywhere and do anything.
Yeah.
And he had the right officer with him, Duncan, I think it was. He did quite well. He went all over the place. But he was lucky. He operated from Malta, and he managed to get a lot of places in the short place of time, you know.
Mm.
But then that's all part.
So what would you, between raids, what would you do?
Pardon?
What would go on between raids? You'd be free to go into town, or
it depend where we were based. Most of the time, we were at Cabrit. You see, we'd always go back to Cabrit to re-equip and that sort of thing.
Right.
Of course, that was our tents were there, and everything else. No, and our main baggage was always there. But sometimes we'd be back at Armaria in Alexandria, in the barracks there.
Right.
There's quite a lot of army barracks there.
Yeah.
On Stanley Bay as well. Sometimes we'd be stationed there. But the officers were always stationed in flats. They always had their private
apartments in Alexandria.
Alexandria and Cairo, yeah.
And Cairo.
Yeah. And then when we came back from when we were wounded, we came back to Sutherland's flat in Alexandria.
Yeah.
And the bath and everything else. And
then what was that like? Was it quite well to do, was it? Or?
Yeah, well, didn't you accept it, you know? They even had his girlfriends there. They had their girlfriends there and everything else.
Yeah.
Young, mostly Greek girls. They were from the...
Did he pay for that privately, or did the army pay for that?
Which?
I think his flat?
Privately, I think.
Right.
And they're always grumbling about their pay and costing. That's what it was. Well, the lieutenants and the captains wasn't enough to keep them going half the time.
I suppose they had...
They're special forces, they're special service pay.